Good afternoon. I'm Kathy Lewis. Wow, I have completely changed my choice of candidate based on your thoughtful social media post, said no one ever. Social media may not be great at persuading people to switch candidate allegiance, but it turns out it is a great vehicle to inform voters about key issues. And if you think your Facebook feed is a little brittle these days as we close in on Election Day, you're right. Today we're exploring the actual impact of social media on Decision 16. Let's talk about it after this news from NPR. We are at 6 minutes past the hour on a great day in Hampton Roads. And by the way, we're taking your temperature today on what you see going on in social media with regard to the election. And it's coming up next week. In the second half of the program, we will talk with a local consultant and physician about the latest on the Affordable Care Act, higher premiums in the forecast, significantly higher in some cases. But November is a big month for the ACA, and if you're participating or thinking about it, there are things you need to know. So we will explore those issues a little bit later today. First, though, we're taking a look at the role of social media in the election, and we're wondering what your Facebook feed is looking like at the moment, whether you have unfriended anybody as a result of what you have seen online. Are you using your Facebook to influence and persuade your friends to your political point of view? Are you done with it? Are you kind of tired of it? We're at 440-2665 or 1-800-940-2240. We're wondering whether you find yourself following people who think differently than you do, or whether you find yourself muting those folks in some way. And again, wondering whether you have lost friendships, either virtual or actual, as a result of this very highly politically charged season. And we're wondering what information you get about your candidates as well on social media. It's 440-2665 or 1-800-940-2240. Aaron Smith has been thinking a lot about this. He's an associate director of research on internet and technology issues at the Pew Research Center. Aaron Smith, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
You are so welcome. We started talking about social media a couple of cycles ago and technology and the like. How have you seen it change since then in terms of our use and perhaps in terms of the impact?
So in terms of usage, it has pretty much become a standard toolkit that people use to get information and engage with political issues. I think the difference here this election cycle, people are really kind of worn out with all of the political content that they're getting on social media. I think as of a few election cycles ago, it was kind of a fun thing for people to do. Now that everyone knows is out there talking about and arguing about and getting into fights about this incredibly contentious election cycle, people are feeling a lot of stress and a lot of just overall frustration at just the volume and the tone of the content that is in their social media feeds at the moment.
You know, it's interesting because, of course, we started the show today saying, wow, I have totally changed my mind about my candidate based on your post, said no one ever. But I guess that might be a little extreme. Do you have any evidence or any research that reflects the ability of people's posts to change the minds of others?
We do. And so actually we asked this question in our survey, and about 1 in 5 social media users said that they had changed their mind about a candidate or about an issue due to the things that they saw on social media. I think the interesting trend there that fits with a lot of the other research that we've seen in this election cycle is that typically they're changing their minds for the worse about someone or something.
Oh, wow.
So they're not necessarily becoming more positively inclined towards Hillary Clinton or Donald Trump. They're becoming much more negatively inclined towards one of the candidates as a result of the information they're seeing. But certainly I'm not sure if that's a good thing or a bad thing, but there is some evidence that at least some of us are changing our minds, often for the worse.
So is there any difference in the way, we'll talk about the two major parties, noting certainly that there are third party candidates and the like in the race, but looking at Democrats and Republicans, are there any differences in the way their party faithful use social media? I mean, does one use it more than the other?
In general, there really aren't a lot of partisan differences on this. So particularly as social media in general and Facebook specifically has become more and more common, it's used by a pretty broad cross-section of the country. And so a lot of the partisan differences that we saw, say, for instance, in the 2008 campaign, when social media was really dominated by younger Obama-supporting folks, nowadays we really don't see a whole lot of differences around political affiliation. And the differences that we do see, and they tend to be pretty marginal. So Republicans and Democrats are equally likely to use social media in general. They tend to post a similar amount of political content. They, interestingly enough, share a lot of the same stresses and frustrations when it comes to just the tone of the conversation. Democrats are a little bit more likely to sort of say that it's a place where they can engage in political activity and sort of reach out around issues that they feel strongly about. But those differences aren't that strong.
Yeah.
So by and large, we tend to use social media pretty similarly, regardless of our political affiliations.
Robinson Meyer's with us as well, an associate editor at The Atlantic, where he covers technology. Rob Meyer, good to have you with us today. Thanks for joining us.
Hey, Kathy, thank you for having me on.
I was very intrigued by one of the things that you note, which is that we are spending as much time socializing on Facebook and social media nearly as much as we do socializing face-to-face. And wow, that has to have tremendous implications in a fraught political culture like the ones we find ourselves in right now.
I think that's right. You know, when you look at these time use surveys, you see that individual companies control huge amounts of just like every an average a part of every American's day. I think Facebook controls 50 minutes of the average American time each day, which is just a lot of time overall. I think, you know, when you start to think about how we understand the world and like think about how other people are understanding to Facebook and Twitter and these social media sites, you do start to realize the importance they have as media products and as ways of kind of understanding the whole, you know, political body, the electorate.
Yeah.
They're windows for us into kind of what our neighbors and friends and, you know, fellow voters are thinking.
Yeah. So you're suggesting at the same time we are sort of locked in our positions and don't necessarily change them much based on what we're seeing, there is also, because of what's coming into our feeds from a news perspective, a real ability to influence this election.
Well, and I think the other thing, too, is that so many social media sites allow us to narrow the kind of information we see. There's a scholar named Cass Sunstein who talks about the echo chamber, which is that if you're constantly only choosing news sources or only choosing information sources that support what you already think or that seem to benefit what you already think, then you will increasingly kind of choose those sources over time until eventually you're in a world of, you know, reality that might have nothing to do with what's actually happening in the world.
Yeah, and it's a great point.
Twitter and Facebook.
Go ahead.
Yeah, they make that easy.
We're having a little bit of a challenge with the phone. No, that is so true. And then my own observation is that once we are in those echo chambers, we know very well how to talk with people who agree with us. We don't necessarily know how to talk to people with whom we disagree. Becca's on the line from Virginia Beach. Hi, Becca. You're on the air.
Hi, Kathy. How are you?
All right. Go right ahead.
So on my Facebook page, I try to keep my personal opinion private, just
okay.
for me. And I'll share lots of different things that I either agree with, don't agree with, not sure how I feel about. And I always caption them, let's discuss. And I make them public so that it can invite, you know, discussion from a wide variety of perspectives. And I ask questions instead of making statements. And it's really opened up a lot of amazing discussions with several different people. And sometimes it has gotten heated and people get, you know, upset and it blows up. But then I'll just privately message them a few days later and say, hey, let's chat. Let's work this out.
Yeah.
And I've had some really amazingly constructive conversations.
Isn't that great? So the social media is the first place it goes, but it gets resolved in sort of verbal conversation and actual connection.
Right.
Really interesting, Becca. Thank you for the call. Kelly's on the line from Yorktown. Hi, Kelly. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for having me on.
You're welcome. Go right ahead.
Just don't know how to save my friendships.
Okay.
I don't have a lot of time to spend on social media, but the little bit of time I do spend on there, I really am disgusted at some of the stuff that is out there. And I want to make sure I can save my friendships.
So does that mean that you are just not having it at all? I mean, or how are you managing that?
No, I'm responding. A lot of it is basically fact checking. You know, these people are posting things that are not factually correct, and I'm showing them the fact check, and it just becomes a battle of wills, and I don't have time for it.
I hear you.
Facebook is supposed to be something fun, not not what it's turned into.
Cat pictures and what we had for dinner, right, Kelly? Thank you for the call. I hear what you're saying, and this is a challenge a lot of people are having on Facebook right now, is the issue of fact-checking, so we're wondering how you're doing that. Jeremy's on the line from Virginia Beach. Hi, Jeremy. You're on the air.
Hello, Kathy.
Hi.
So I wanted to bring up, echoing the last caller, that, you know, there's so many fake news sites. I mean, the one that comes to mind is the Baltimore Gazette, you know, this Reconstruction-era newspaper that sort of sprang back to life and is filled with fake news. And I'm wondering if your guests can comment on these satirical news sites, the blatant fake news that's out there, and just this sort of lack of fact that's running around on Twitter and Facebook.
Jeremy, it's a great question. I'm not sure who wants to answer it. Let's start with Aaron Smith. Jeremy brings up a great point. There are a lot of posts out there that seem like they might be from legitimate news sites, and perhaps not. Aaron Smith.
I was actually going to chime in, if you don't mind, on the second caller's issue, which I think I'll let Rob handle the call at the moment. But I think she touches on a really crucial point here, which is that we've got, you know, centuries of history on how to manage these kind of fraught discussions in our interpersonal lives when we're sitting across the dinner table from someone or talking to someone face to face. And I think what a lot of people are experiencing, like your caller was, is that, you know, all of their, you know, friends that they've made over the course of their lives, who in many cases they didn't, you know, become friends with because of their political leanings or have any real interest in hearing about their political leanings, are now obsessively posting, you know, political news, political commentary, in these kind of quasi-public spaces that we haven't really figured out entirely how to navigate them more of. And so I think that gets at the heart of what does make this stressful for a lot of people, is that we're being inundated with this content from people, you know, who we didn't, you know, really care what their political views were, and it wasn't why we became friends with them in the first place. Yet now it's sort of inescapable in certain ways every time we log into our feed. So I think that really gets at an important issue for why this is challenging for a lot of folks.
Such a good point. Rob Meyer, what can you tell us about some of these fake news sites that seem to populate our feeds?
Yeah, absolutely. So there are certainly a lot of them. And in fact, BuzzFeed News, the news part of BuzzFeed, which I think some people may think of as at least a sensational news site, but does really excellent political reporting. They recently did an investigation that found the biggest partisan pages on Facebook, the biggest pages posting political news, they include Freedom Daily and Occupy Democrats, were often posting what appeared to be news that wasn't particularly satirical and that might have had an element of truth, but that was, in fact, selectively curated or selectively edited so as to, like, bias a certain viewpoint. The example being, there was a story that ran, I believe, on the Facebook page called Freedom Daily that they posted and that linked to their own site, that made it look like two black men who were implied to be two Black Lives Matter protesters had beat up a third person after they had contradicted their political views or argued against them or something. And it was made to look like two Black Lives Matter protesters had beat up a third man who was white. In fact, the third man race was left out. He was black and it had nothing to do with Black Lives Matter. It was just a case of violence that was not really particularly political. So there's a lot of this in, especially on Facebook. It's very popular and Facebook right now doesn't seem to want to do anything kind of proactive to address it. So, I mean, I agree with the guest that it's a huge problem. And right now, our ways of dealing with it seem to be fairly minimal on the kind of systemic side, on the broad side, until Facebook actively, you know, tries to take some approaches to it.
Interesting. Kit's on the line from Norfolk. Hi, Kit. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
You're Kit welcome.
I just wanted to say that as regards to social media, most of my conversations about politics that actually got anywhere or where I feel like I even attempted to convince anybody were during the primaries when I was a Bernie supporter among some Hillary supporters. And I feel like everything was a lot more positive then, and you could actually have a conversation. And you could have disagreements when you're talking about Jill Stein, Hillary, Bernie, people like that. But with the kind of the blatant race baiting and other things that are going on from across the aisle, I can't interact with that. It drives up my blood pressure. And I've actually been off of Facebook, at least my Facebook feed, since April now.
Wow.
My mother and I both worked at the same law firm. She left shortly after because she has to work with people that have variously different political views. And she found that it was easier and less stressful to simply not know their political views from their Facebook feeds.
Wow. So clarify. Are you saying she left her job because of
that? No,
okay.
No, I'm sorry.
I just want to make sure.
She can't leave her job. She
got
left
it.
Facebook.
She
we
just,
both left Facebook.
Now I got you.
And not had Twitter.
Yeah.
And so it makes it a lot easier to work across the desk from somebody when you don't listen to the crazy things they say online.
Kit, I thank you for the call. Aaron Smith, it seems to me that that Kit has the strategy that many others have adopted as well.
He certainly does. And I will say that he also highlights a really key element of this, which is that it's hard to separate what's happening on social media from just the broader political context in general. And what we've seen in the work that my organization and others done is that over the last several election cycles, just the parties have gotten further apart, and people are much more likely now to, you know, view people on the opposite side of the aisle as, you know, as bad people, as dangerous people, to feel more fearful of people who don't share their political viewpoints. And so in a lot of ways, this is sort of endemic to just the political environment we're living in right now.
Wow.
There are some you know, definite elements to social media that make this particularly challenging, as Kit alluded to there.
Mm. Aaron Smith, I want to thank you for joining us today and for the great research you're doing as Associate Director of Research on Internet and Technology Issues at the Pew Research Center. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you so much.
You're welcome. Take care. We're at 25 minutes past the hour. Rob Meyer remaining with us. He's an associate editor at The Atlantic, where he covers technology and looks at how people are using social media. Rob, we've actually had a very interesting example, at least it's interesting to us, of how social media has become a part of a campaign. We have a question on the Tuesday ballot in the resort city of Virginia Beach. It has to do with light rail. And often in an undercurrent on that conversation there emerges issues around race relations. Most people acknowledge that. So, and I'm not airing bits of this clip, by the way, in any sort of endorsement of either side, but just as an example of how social media has been used in this campaign. The one side decided that they would take a listen and a look and respond to some of the social media comments that had been posted at a related site.
These are actual quotes from the Mission Transport VB Facebook page. Should be good. Instead of building the failed light rail to Virginia Beach, how about we use those funds to build a wall between us and Norfolk?
Between us and Norfolk.
Which would make getting to work difficult for me.
Wow.
These people are really mean.
Sorry, we don't need Norfolk's trash.
Wow.
Yeah, that's...
We don't use light rail to get rid of our trash.
We have trash cans around. We're not just throwing their trash around. Anybody who lives in Norfolk should be offended by this.
They're getting right down to it now.
That's a pretty close-minded thing to say.
Let's keep the emotion out of it, people.
It's just a clip from some of those reactions and responses, and this thing was shared very broadly on Facebook. Rob Meyer, I wonder, is that an example of what we're seeing in terms of taking comments that are made on Facebook and looking at them as part of a larger narrative? Because that issue, some of those issues that were raised in those clips have been very hard to raise and very hard to talk about in a lot of ways.
I think so. And I think the other thing is that it reflects the degree to which when people are on social media, at least from what I was able to tell from the clip and from other, you know, press reports I've heard about this, because I'm in D.C. and we, our media markets do overlap slightly. I think it reflects the fact that people on social media, you know, people even using their real name on Facebook have no problem saying things, you know, typing things out and posting them online that they might bristle at saying in person, or that they might not show up at a public fair, like a public space to say. And so therefore,
That's really changing our conversation, it seems to me. If we and boy, I tell you, we're seeing this all over the place, that there are things, as you say, that you would say online, perhaps, that you probably would not say to a person face to face. Let's go to Kevin on the line from Virginia Beach. Hi, Kevin, you're on the air.
Hi, Kathy.
Hi. Go right ahead.
Oh, great. You know, my original comment was about just the use of social media when with the voting that you talked about prior, but now that we're going on this, it's actually perfect timing, because something I've noticed lately with people, millennials specifically, in the use of social media, and when issues like this come up, and there's race and there's blurred lines, and you kind of see things on both sides of the aisle, like Kit brought up earlier, it's really what I've found people using social media is like less of a thing for open discussion and more of a platform for, like, attacking the other side. You know, the proverbial side, the lines don't seem to be so clear, because there's so much language that's not getting used. Can't read someone's body language on social media or facial expressions or understand really what they're trying to convey.
Yeah.
It's all just words, and it seems like more harm than good for
Andrew. I appreciate the call. You know, you've brought up something really interesting about communication and the inability to be able to see someone's eyes, to watch someone's face, to see how their body language is. And the fact of the matter is, I've seen this happen on Facebook as well. Very often you'll have scenarios where people don't necessarily interpret sarcasm the way the poster may have intended it. So that's a piece of what you're talking about as well, Andrew. Thank you for the call. So our questions for you today, dear listeners, have to do with how you are managing social media in this very fraught political season? Are you somebody who has perhaps been off Facebook? Some of our earlier callers, one of our earlier callers said he's been off since April because he just finds it much easier to work with people not knowing what their political agenda is. Or are you someone who has tried to engage in debates and dialogue on Facebook? What are you noticing in terms of social media? It certainly is playing a role in the election. That it's how a lot of message management is being done and the like. So we're at, in fact, trending right now. Trending right this very minute. This is on the side of Donald Trump. There is a new hashtag Hillary for prison trending. So there you have it. I mean, it's very much a part of how we are debating and how we are analyzing and processing these issues. And so we're wondering, are you engaging it? Are you buying it? Are you critically looking at the news, quote unquote, news sites that are posted? What are you noticing? 440-2665, 1-800-940-2240. Let's go to Kevin on the line from Virginia Beach. Andrew from Williamsburg, I thought we just spoke with Andrew. Maybe I'm wrong. We're at 29 minutes before the hour. Andrew, hi, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi. Mark Twain was very prescient and very observant about this. When I see Facebook debates, I always think of him saying, never try to teach a pig to whistle. It wastes your time and annoys the pig. When it comes to Facebook, I think he had no way of knowing that a lie can make it around the world before the truth gets on its shoes, which was another quote of his. And it really amazes me how far ahead of his time he was. Prefiguring this.
Yeah, it's a very good point, Andrew. And I thank you for the call. And certainly in the environment in which we find ourselves now, with so many more opportunities to get the word out, those prescient comments by Mark Twain are probably more true now than they have ever been. 440-2665, 1-800-940-2240. Rob Meyer, what can you tell us? Because, you know, this is the other thing that strikes me that is a piece of this conversation. Is about what kind of news is coming into our feed. As a technology expert, what can you tell us about the process by which the interwebs choose what comes into our feed? I presume there's much more out there than actually winds up in our feed.
That's totally right. And, you know, on Twitter, it's pretty straightforward because you follow a number of accounts. You pretty much choose the accounts you follow. And then, they put news in your feed. On Facebook, it's a little more complicated. That on Facebook, you know, your feed is controlled by this news feed algorithm. What we don't really know a lot about how the algorithm works, except that Facebook tells us it selects for things that are engaging, you know, things that seem to get likes or shares or comments, things that people tend to read as opposed to just scroll through or open and then quickly close. And we know that Facebook, like whenever you open your news feed, Facebook could choose from like 2,000 different, you know, pieces of content, posts or photos that it could show you, and somehow it chooses 20. We really don't know a lot about like how the actual how that works, kind of beyond the loose parameters that Facebook likes to use, though.
It's a great point. 27 minutes before the hour, we're at 440-2665. 1-800-940-2240. Miranda is on the line from Norfolk. Hi, Miranda. You're on the air.
Hey. So my birthday is actually 12 days after the last presidential election. So this is the first one that I'll get to actually vote in.
Ah, wonderful.
And so, you know, I've very much gotten into going online and kind of debating with people from, you know, all sides of the aisle, just to kind of figure out where I fell, because this is just such a bizarre election. And it got to a point where I've kind of decided for the last 2 weeks up until the 8th that I'm just not on social media anymore, because the backlash has just kind of become a little too much.
What do you mean when you say backlash, Miranda? What do you mean by that?
Well, they get very, you know, this is a very kind of high stakes election, or I think that's how a lot of people view it right now. So people are very, very personal with how they kind of respond if you want to have a debate.
Really interesting, Miranda. I thank you for the call. Denise on line three sounds like has a similar issue. Hi, Denise, you're on the air.
Hi, thank you. I didn't get to hear that last commenter, but basically something I've noticed lately is that if I or someone else posts something, whether it's political or, you know, a religious post or something, someone else coming on that is very hostile or has a hostile remark. And I have an issue with that because if you don't like what I post, you know, you can block me, unfriend me, but don't come onto my page and be hostile about it. I think it's really rude. Go ahead and post what you want on your page.
Sure.
And I'm not going to say anything about that. I'm just going to silently disagree with you. But I've noticed lately that especially with the political issues going on, people have felt very free to be very critical of their so-called friends.
That is such an interesting point, Denise, because it points up the different ways in which people are using Facebook. I know plenty of people who feel as you do that they have sort of an unwritten rule that says, look, it's my page, so don't attack me on my page. And others who say, well, look, you know, if you're putting it out there for comment and Facebook is a social media, then clearly you want comment. Rob Meyer, are you detecting this as well? And is that, do you suspect that's at all generational? I wonder about that.
I wonder if it's generational too. It is interesting though, because I think the last caller raises like a good point about how this, none of this translates to the physical world. You know, if you put out a yard sign in your front yard, I think that is widely understood to be completely your prerogative, and your neighbors might disagree with you, but they're welcome to put out their own yard signs, and no one is going to show up at your front door, kind of bang on your door, and be like, how dare you put out that yard sign? That's not a norm we have on Facebook, partly because Facebook always has that comment box there. Maybe if you could staple letters to yard signs, that would be different. I think one thing, too, that, you know, we talk about in social media studies is how, and it goes to the body language thing that we were talking about earlier, how if you're with someone, you can read their body language. You know, when you're hanging out with people or when you're in a public meeting, there's always a context for that. You're either with your high school friends or you're with, you know, old college friends, or you're with, you know, other parents at a school your children attend. There's always a context for an environment that you're talking about politics in, or, you know, just talking about the world.
Right.
You always have things to talk about. On Facebook, on Twitter, those contexts disappear. They collapse because you're talking to all those people at once. You know, you're talking to maybe your parents and your friends and your coworkers and old acquaintances. And so what you tend to talk about or what you tend to think about is these big things that affect everyone, like politics, you know, or like sports. And so what we talk about in social media studies is like called context collapse. And it's how maybe the more time you spend on Facebook and the more, or any social media, and the more all those different social worlds that you inhabit every day kind of blur together, the more politicized and irate and frustrating the conversation tends to get.
That is fascinating. Denise, thank you for the call. I love that analogy to think of one's Facebook wall, perhaps if it works for you, as sort of the sign in the yard. It's sort of a different set of expectations, isn't it? 20 minutes before the hour, Natalie's going to wrap it up for us today from Virginia Beach. Hi, Natalie. You're on the air.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call.
You're welcome.
A lot of my comments have been kind of already said in terms of, you know, how you're dealing with people that post something that I find perhaps, you know, offensive. There's certainly been some people that I've hidden on my page, just because I don't want to necessarily see that kind of ugly side right now.
Yeah.
But also, I have a lot of other friends that are posting animal little videos, because they'll say something along the lines of, you know, to lighten your day, to get away from the ugly political debates, you know, here's a cute puppy video.
Right. But go ahead.
On the last caller, Rob, the one of the people there on the panel, really interesting in terms of the mix of all the people that we have on our social media. And that's probably what I've found Facebook most useful for, is really trying to understand somebody that has a different view than mine, where they're coming from and what's motivating them to be behind a certain candidate. And so I think that's what, for me personally, has been most informative about Facebook, even though I've, you know, been in some conversations on Facebook where I have found it, you know, really hostile, and I've always tried to just ask questions so that I can understand somebody else versus making some negative comment. So that's all, and I'll take my response offline.
Yeah, great point, Natalie, and I thank you for the call. I've noticed that too. People are posting animal videos and flower videos and all kinds of things. I thank you for the call. I don't know about you, Rob Meyer, but I think a week is about all we can take.
Oh my gosh! Just I am so hoping that whatever the result is, it is clear Tuesday night. Wednesday morning we come in. There's a new president, and you know, then it's over. At least for now.
Fair enough, Rob Meyer. We'll check in again after the election and see how everything is going. I really appreciate your being with us today from The Atlantic.
Absolutely. Thank you for having me.
Take care. Rob Meyer covers technology as an associate editor for The Atlantic. And we'll be back in just a moment. We're going to be talking about an important six-week period that begins today with regard to the Affordable Care Act. Stay with us. Welcome back. We're at 18 minutes past the hour. I trust that your political discourse is delightful, inspiring, and civil as you are online. The other big story of the day has to do with the Affordable Care Act, an important period that begins today. Dr. Brian Fine with us today. He's the CEO of Percentric, and he's a practicing pediatric hospitalist at Children's Hospital. Nice to meet you. Thank you for being here.
Nice to meet you.
So you doctor all the time in the hospital, right?
Frequently.
Yeah. And what caused you to take a look at this, at the way people are using health insurance and the way companies are looking at that?
Yeah, I mean, we're seeing increasingly that families are becoming more savvy to their health benefits. I obviously see it with parents and their children, and we're getting more letters, we're getting more questions, and it's sort of a necessary consideration when you practice medicine these days.
Interesting. So we know that on average, we've been told that the policy premiums on healthcare.gov are going to go up about 25% in 2017. That's very average, could be more in some cases, could be less. What do you want people to know about that in terms of this important six-week period we're in?
Yeah. Well, it's certainly going up. One of the reasons, I mean, the simplest reason why the premiums are going up is that they haven't sort of gotten the healthy people, as many healthy people as they thought, into the marketplace. It's important. It's a complex process in many ways. We're just trying to help people, help families understand the process, and help businesses, in particular small businesses, understand the process, because their employees frequently will be trying to access the marketplace through healthcare.gov.
Sure. And of course, the requirements are, well, give us a sense of the requirements, because we know that a lot of young people who have been faced with the requirement to purchase insurance or pay the fine for not purchasing are going ahead and paying the fine. And that's a problem.
And that's I mean, that's some of the, if you would say, sort of the finance or the politics behind the issue, is trying to find that line where the products on this marketplace are something that a healthy, immortal, air quotes, immortal, yes. somebody will want to find value in, versus just saying, okay, well, at the end of the day, I'll just pay the $695 or whatever and take my chances.
Yeah. So your enrollment, if you are going to purchase insurance through healthcare.gov, and we note that there are about 400,000 Virginians who've used that marketplace in the last couple of years. Perhaps these are people who don't have a job or have a job that doesn't have health insurance. A lot of those are small businesses particularly. If you are somebody who is in that boat or contemplating it, this is an important period. Your enrollment has to be completed by December 15th. So what advice do you have for people?
So the window is November 1st until January 31st. It's December 15th. You'll be able to be enrolled as of January 1st, 2017. But for this year, you'll still have an extended window next year as well. And then ultimately, it's going to become November 1st to December 15th. It's important that people start to understand and think about it. Today's day one. Try and find access to the website, look around, talk about it with their family, talk about it with their employer. And the employers need to consider it as well.
Are you finding people having, because one of the concerns this time around was it would be fewer options to choose from.
Yeah.
What's your sense of that?
So Virginia, we're doing okay, Hampton Roads specifically, as far as the options that you're going to find there. You'll probably see premium increases. To start, this area has fewer insurers on the marketplace. Mm-hmm. We're not as robust as a big metropolitan area with the number of insurers. Locally, we should be less affected by that, though Virginia statewide is having some insurers back off.
Yeah.
And again, that goes back to the reason why is that there are more sick people are signing up and the healthy people, the tidal wave hasn't happened yet.
Sure. This has been an issue in the presidential campaign, certainly, and the options range from, or the opinion options seem to range from abolish the ACA to tweak it, adjust it. Where are you as a physician on that issue, as somebody who watches people come in and out of the system every day?
Yeah. So the initiative that we're trying to do is stay fairly apolitical about it in regards to this is what we have now. That's from a sort of consulting standpoint. As a physician, we're going to see the challenges that come with buying. There's a term called underinsured, which is people get insurance, but with a high deductible. In practice, they're still going to be paying a lot out of pocket after they seek out medical care, which makes it important that physicians become more savvy to the decisions that we make and how we interact with patients.
What you're prescribing and what kinds of options are available. One of the things we've heard, and I want to get, you may know this, you may not, one of the things we've heard is that the premiums would have been much higher without the ACA. And of course, in Virginia, we have a little bit of a wrinkle as well, because our state has not done Medicaid expansion.
Right. And so where that really sort of traps people sometimes is, and it's counterintuitive, is that there's a subset of the population who, because Medicaid hasn't been expanded, they're not eligible for Medicaid, but they don't make enough money. And so they're not eligible for the subsidies in the marketplace. It's the semantics of the law. Mm-hmm. And so we do have that sort of unfortunate carve out. The Affordable Care Act is trying to create a solution, and it certainly is facing challenges. And the thing that we are trying to help out is the complexity. Mm-hmm.
But I'm trying to get a sense as a consultant, and I get that you're trying to stay political. I understand that. But as somebody who works in a very complex scenario right now on the
sure.
front end on patient care and also on this sort of organizational administrative end, it is complex. So does it make sense from your perspective to tweak it or get rid of it? I mean, I think a lot of people are sort of pondering that right about now.
I think that's fair. Putting me on the spot. I like it. I think there are some tweaks, and maybe you can use a more profound word, even some overhaul,
readjustment.
There's something,
yes.
Like you said, public health, taking public
Revamp,
health questions,
yeah.
And you can always find a cover story that meets both sides of an issue.
Uh-huh.
And we're seeing all, both sides. It provides good in the pediatric world. There's an increased coverage for kids up to 26. People like that. There are some people who are finding that they can get insurance when they couldn't. I mean, these are those arguments. And then you do find people who, you know, are offended or don't want to have the mandate, which makes some sense. The idea of people being covered is a good thing.
Yeah.
And they need to understand it as best they can so that they don't get surprised.
Because it is the law right now, right?
And, it is currently the law.
Yeah, this is where we are. Stephanie's on the line from Suffolk. Hi, Stephanie. You're on the air.
Hi. I volunteered at a free clinic, and I know some of our patients tried to do the Affordable Care Act. Mm-hmm. They had to come back within a month or two because they couldn't afford the premiums, or they couldn't afford prescriptions after they, you know, were seen by doctors on it. Just the word out that there are free clinics, mm-hmm, or reduced pay options out there for people. Please have them look into it. Same doctors that you're going to get on the outside, because of what the doctor said. If you're unemployed or you don't make a certain amount, you don't even qualify for the subsidies, and it's unaffordable. It's the Unaffordable Care Act for many people.
Stephanie, I thank you for the call. Stephanie's call, though, brings up a question about this Medicaid expansion issue, which is something
correct,
the state has struggled with. Governor McAuliffe wants Medicaid to be expanded. It maybe I'm wrong about this, but it seems to me that some of the folks that Stephanie is seeing in the free clinic might, if Medicaid expansion were the law, be eligible for care under that. Maybe I'm wrong about that.
No, I think, generally speaking, you're exactly right. Medicaid is classically, I mean, it's going to protect the kids. It's going to protect the disabled. The people who are struggling are going to be the low-income single adults, or couples, and, you know, as Stephanie mentioned, that aren't going to be able to, they're going to fall through the cracks in Virginia. And that is something that is a consideration.
Yeah, and we know that small businesses are really challenged by this because, you know, this is one of the largest expenses for businesses is healthcare. And I think there's a lot of people who really want to offer healthcare, and yet it's just a very, very challenging scenario in which we find ourselves. So, you know, what I wonder about is we've had this conversation as well about tying health insurance to employment. You're working with a lot of employers, helping them sort of analyze their coverage options. Do you think, are there other ways we could be getting at that? Because your perspective is interesting in that you're seeing patients on the front line and you're working on this back end issue.
Yeah, I mean, we are unique
yeah,
America in many ways, and health benefits is one. Started in World War II time with tying it to wages, and it's just grown. And as you know, with anything with public health, undoing something is extraordinarily difficult. You know, there are models in other countries, and those as well have pros and cons. I don't look at it from the,
yeah,
you know, 50,000 foot,
sure,
or I'm not right
in
now
the trenches. Yeah,
saying what is the politics behind it.
Sure. Are you, though, as a physician, are you, how do I say this? Are you mindful of this when you prescribe and when you treat your patients?
I'm trying to be, and it's interesting how it's come full circle where, you know, do we want to be aware of people's insurance? These days we kind of have to, and it's less about what they're going to, like, it revolves around being able to provide them prescriptions or things that they need under that insurer, understanding the burden that individual families might face with decisions that we make.
Right.
I mean, some things that physicians do are based on risk and benefits, and you find there's a, I don't want to say a coin flip component to it, but you're just trying to say, in my mind, I think it's better for the family. And when you have to then consider that your decision can cost a person,
sure,
significant dollars.
How are you having these conversations, particularly around prescriptions? I've talked to so many people who've had this experience. Doc prescribes a prescription, they take it to the pharmacist, and all of a sudden, you know, last year it was in the lower tier, and this year it's in the higher tier, and then you got to call back and see if there's another option. I wonder from exactly the perspective you're talking about, are you talking with your colleagues about looking at those issues? I guess that's almost a, a staffing administrative issue to sort of catch that on the front end, because it seems like it would create a lot of work for your staff. If I'm at the pharmacist, I decide I don't want to pay $600 for this. Now I'm calling back. That feels like it creates more work for your staff.
So we are. So we're trying. We talk about it as a team, you know, over at KD where I work. I also work with EVMS residents and students, and we're trying to introduce this to them so it becomes just more of their normal.
Yeah,
you know, these, I grew up through a sort of a Google age where now we understand that families are going to Google what you say, spell it out for them. So hey, you're going to Google this. And I think increasingly this conversation just by necessity is going to be frontline.
Is it inappropriate to, for a patient sitting in your office when you prescribe something for them, for them to say, hang on a minute, let me just look that up and make sure that that's a tier in my prescription coverage that I'm comfortable with?
Of course it's not inappropriate. I mean, the reason
I'm asking,
from a doctor's standpoint, they could all, there's never inappropriate things for them to say almost.
Well, but I mean, you know, that's a generational issue, and a lot of older people are not going to challenge the doctor in any way. Not challenge,
fair,
but, you know, at least inquire about that. So we're just trying to sort of help people give some other options, that the doctor's A-okay if you walk in and say, hey, you know, can we just take a look and make sure that that's a tier that, you know,
we're increasingly seeing that savviness. I mean, I would say to my physician colleagues, like, we're increasingly seeing that savviness. We're getting letters from families asking very, like, solid, detailed questions about how their insurance works and, you know, things that were done. So you're just
different
a better
world.
Doctor if you can understand some of this stuff.
Yeah, really different world, isn't it? Dr. Brian Fine, thank you for being with us. The company is called Percentric, PercentriC.com. Again, very important period for anyone, about 400,000 Virginians who have been using that marketplace. You want to check it out, healthcare.gov. Sometimes there are challenges with this website, so, you know, keep at it. That's the point, because it's important. Thanks for being with us today.
No worries.
Thank you for being with us as well. We should note that coming up next here on 89.5, it is the Thomas Jefferson Hour. And then coming up tonight on WHRO TV 15 at 8 o'clock, they're doing this very interesting series, which I know you've been watching, called The Contenders, 16 for 16. And they've been looking back at presidential elections of the past. Probably some you thought were the most consequential elections of your lifetime, until this year. And so it's really interesting to look at this perspective. 16 for 16 tonight features the Bush-Obama race, and it's called The Master Strategists, the campaign strategies and messaging of George W. Bush and Barack Obama are examined. And then at 9 o'clock, it's American Experience. They're going to be revisiting a pivotal 1950 Korean War battle through the eyewitness accounts of participants. So that's a war about which we don't know a whole lot. That's coming up tonight at 9 on American Experience. I should clarify, if you were there, you do know quite a lot about it. But if you weren't, you may not. By the way, coming up Sunday, November 6th, the Virginia Museum of Contemporary Art is hosting, this is so fun, that's why I want you to know about it, the 8th Annual House of Blues, Brews, and Stews. They worked that menu to get those to rhyme. I'm confident of that. It's 1 to 5 o'clock out at the Museum of Contemporary Art. They're going to have Anthony Rosano and the Conqueroos and a whole lot of bands. It's Rain or Shine, and it benefits MoCA's exhibitions and education programming. So that's coming up Sunday, November 6th. From 1 to 5, and that's a very, very reasonable ticket price. So you want to check out the MoCA website for more information, virginiamoca.org. Thanks for listening. We'll see you right back here tomorrow.